If you like Area 45, you're going to enjoy the Hoover Institution's other podcasts, Uncommon Knowledge, The Classicist with Victor Davis Hanson, and The Libertarian with Richard Epstein. Subscribe now to the Hoover Podcast at hoover.org/podcasts. That's hoover.org/podcasts. Hoover Podcast, ideas defining a free society. Hello, it's Wednesday, October the 30th, and you're listening to Area 45, a Hoover Institution podcast examining the policy avenues available to the 45th President of the United States. I'm Bill Whalen, the Hoover Institution's Virginia Hobbs Carpenter Research Fellow. My guest today in Hoover's recording studio here on the campus of Stanford University is Dr. and Colonel Joseph Felter. Joe Felter is a Hoover Institution Research Fellow and the William J. Perry Fellow at the Stanford-based Center for International and Security Cooperation. Till last month, he was the Deputy Assistant Secretary of Defense for South and Southeast Asia, which means he was the principal advisor to senior Pentagon leadership for all policy matters pertaining to development and implementation of defense strategies and plans for the region. A former U.S. Army Special Forces and Foreign Area Officer, Colonel Felter served in a variety of special operations and diplomatic assignments. He also participated in multiple combat deployments, including Panama with the 75th Ranger Regiment, Iraq with the Joint Special Operations Task Force, and Afghanistan, where he commanded the COMASAF Counterinsurgency Advisory and Assistance Team. Joe Felter is a graduate of West Point, Harvard's Kennedy School of Government, and he holds a PhD in political science from Stanford University. Joe, I know very well what an SOB is, but tell me, what in military parlance is SOF?
SOF. Yeah, well, thanks. First of all, thanks for the chance to join you here, Bill. And, you've done some great podcasts in the past. I hope I don't interrupt your great track record. But SOF is Special Operations Force, and that encompasses across the services, the Army, Navy, and Air Force, and Marine Corps. Mm-hmm. So Special Operations Force, for example, the Army would, the main elements there would be the Army Special Forces, the Green Berets as their nickname, or the Army Rangers, Task Force 160, Special Operations Aviation Regiment, and some civil affairs and SIOPS units. Mm-hmm. Navy, you've got the SEALs, that you know, Navy Special Warfare units. Air Force, you've got a range of, we call them pararescue and a special tactics squadron, and some of the platforms like the AC-130 gunships, C-130 combat talents, and other things. And the Marine Corps has also their own special operations, you know, the MARSOC, Marine Special Operations Command.
So these are the fellows who are in the news this weekend for that little event that transpired in Syria, correct?
Yeah, great event. And, you know, you read what you read in the news. I think within the community, and I serve in this community, we still avoid providing too much detail, but certainly it's out there. But absolutely, this was a great example of just the capabilities of the U.S. Special Operations Forces, the intelligence support that works with them, and so many other aspects of our military. But great win for the United States Special Operations Forces.
Having been in that world, Joe, what struck you as kind of unique or especially clever about that raid?
Well, I don't want to discount the significance of it, but I wouldn't say it was. When I say it's not unique, I say that as a compliment to the special operators.
Meaning this is what they train.
This is what they do. This is what they do day in, day out. Sometimes it gets great attention. Mm-hmm. The fact that Abu Bakr al-Baghdadi was the leader of ISIS and certainly about when you say high value target, that's about you couldn't get much higher.
Right.
But substitute another person or another mission, it could be just as hard, just as dangerous. Just as challenging and just as much a tribute to the proficiency and capabilities of our Special Operations Force. So they do this day in and day out, and this is a great example of just how good they are, and we should really be thankful we have them on our side.
This being a Trump podcast, we have to talk about the president for a minute, and as with all things with Donald Trump, there was a little blowback when he gave his announcement of the death, and there was some criticism that he gave away too much information about the raid.
You know, I saw that. I'm not sure exactly what...
He went into detail about the operation, and some people pushed back and said he gave too much information about the operation.
I think in principle, you don't want to provide information that can give our enemies any insights on our tactics and techniques and procedures. But he's a commander-in-chief, and he can decide at what threshold is too much.
Yeah. So let me ask you the question, Joe, that I ask of any guest who has a service background, an academy background. What gravitated you toward West Point, and what interested you in getting and having a military career?
Well, thanks. I think like a lot of us at 18, you don't have your life figured out. But West Point seemed to be a great opportunity for me. I think at some level I recognize I needed a bit of structure and discipline at 18. But I think when I visited West Point and I saw, I felt just such a connection to history and all the really great leaders that went before me there. And if I could have a chance to follow in their footsteps, even a couple of those steps, it would have been a great privilege. So just thought I'd sign for 5 years, maybe get out, go to law school, do something new. But I ended up working with some fantastic senior leaders and peers and subordinates, and you know, stayed on for 24 years.
Right. Now, when you sit in on roundtables with the great legendary George Shultz, we go around the room and every fellow introduces himself out of protocol and respect. Secretary Shultz goes last. And I've always, first time I was in one of these things, I was really interested in how he'd introduce himself because I thought, my God, he could go on for 30 minutes with everything he's done. You know how he introduces himself, Joe? He just says, George Shultz, United States Marine Corps.
I do. And that says so much, Bill. I mean, I think it says volumes. I mean, here he's had multiple cabinet posts. But when he says George Shultz, Marine, it means that he's committed to serving the nation. Something he did early on and fighting across the Pacific in World War II. Mm-hmm. I think it says a lot about George Shultz and his commitment to public service, because you can't serve, I think, at any greater level than laying your life down on the line for your country.
Exactly. So not too long ago, Joe, you found yourself working at the Department of Defense, working on South Asia, Southeast Asia, Oceania policy. Is this the path that you saw for yourself when you entered West Point, when you were commissioned, as you worked your way up the ladder? Is this how you saw yourself ultimately?
I wouldn't say I saw myself there. I was honored and privileged to have that opportunity. Mm-hmm. Early on in my career, I spent a lot of time in what we then called the Asia-Pacific region, mm-hmm. my first tour in Korea. Spent several years in the Philippines, working in special forces out of Okinawa, across the region, Thailand, Malaysia, Indonesia, those countries. So I had some background in the region, and then following my operational time in special forces, serving as a foreign area officer in the region. So I had some time in the region, and I was here at Stanford, actually, and got to know then Jim Mattis, as he liked to be called and insisted on being called, although it's hard for military person to call General Mattis Jim, but try to get used to it.
Anyone who's not met Jim Mattis, it's the first thing. Hello, General Mattis. Call me Jim.
Right. So I felt more comfortable when I was back at the Pentagon calling him Secretary Mattis, like all of us. But when he got nominated, he called me in and asked me if I'd consider serving and where I might want to serve. And I said, sir, anyway, since it's sorry. I've had some time in this region. I'll serve wherever you want me. But this is an area where I think I might bring some experience that might be relevant. And he gave me the great chance to serve in this capacity, and it was just an enormous privilege.
One thing I like about doing this podcast, Joe, is I learn something every day by doing this. And one thing I learned for this podcast is the National Defense Strategy. Tell me, what is NDS?
Yeah, great. So the National Defense Strategy, and I could give you if I can, and cut me off if it's too long, let me just
it's a podcast. Run with it.
Okay. Well, it's our national defense strategy, which flows from our national security strategy, which every administration develops. But we developed a national security strategy when the administration took over, and then Secretary Mattis personally led a concerted effort to develop a national defense strategy that flowed from that. Mm-hmm. But let me just describe how we got to one of the main tenets of our national security strategy and our national defense strategy is that we are now, the great power competition is back, that we are, in fact, in long-term competition with Russia and China. And if I could just take a minute some people look at that as a little bit maybe martial, a little bit aggressive. What are we trying to go back to the Cold War here?
Actually, before we do that, let's clarify what power competition means with Russia and China. Are we talking military or a combination of military and economic influence?
Well, I think it's even beyond that. We see Russia and certainly China competing with the United States and other countries, with a whole government response across all dimensions of national power, diplomatic, informational, military, economic, and beyond. So Sun Tzu tells you have to fight a strategy with a strategy, and if they're going to fight us at multiple dimensions, we need to, when I say fight, we need to compete on multiple dimensions, because mm-hmm. to be clear, this is a strategy that doesn't aspire to conflict, it aspires to compete successfully against competitors, that are competing with us.
Right.
But if I could just set the stage a little bit, and Bill, cut me off of this more detail than you'd like, but think back to to when the wall came down, to the end of the Cold War. That was a pretty good time for America. I mean, mm-hmm. you look at, we arguably prevailed in the Cold War, and I would argue that this was a whole of government competition that we, military was a big part of it, so was the economic.
And in 2 years, it'll be 30 years since the wall.
30 years. Right. So think back, it was a pretty good time for America there. Mm-hmm. You look at Russia, it had promising trends towards democracy. Right. We thought it was heading down a path, that the Soviet Union was breaking up, the former Soviet states were independent. Russia looked like it was on a promising potentially promising path towards democracy and freedoms. I mean, we looked at China, and as a maybe later in life academic, think of some of our economic theories, modernization theory. We thought as if a country's economy grows, you look across the universe of cases. Good things happen to a country. They become more liberal. You have a growing middle class. It demands greater political participation. Mm-hmm. It becomes in those countries' interest to become a more responsible member of the international community, join international organizations. So certainly we saw China's economy growing. We said, yeah, good things are going to happen in China. We just need to allow its economy to continue to grow, and we can anticipate these great things happening. So we even let it in some international organizations like the WTO, cut them some slack. But right. But let me just fast forward it to when this administration came on board and was obliged to develop their national security strategy. Things didn't turn out the way we'd hoped. You look at certainly Putin's Russia as a far cry from the hopes we had when the wall came down. Just pointing to things they're doing in Ukraine and in Venezuela, assassinations in the UK, mm-hmm. Cyber attacks, meddling with elections, the list goes on. Right. Then with China, absolutely, we did not see the reforms we'd hoped for. The Communist Party led China right now is engaging in some activities that we find and should find very disturbing. From its investment around the world, this Belt and Road Initiative, we see places like Djibouti developing bases. In my own region, the region I worked on in the Defense Department, it would invest in places like in Sri Lanka. A place called Hambantota Port is a great example, where they would build. Countries would incur these incredible debt burdens, and they couldn't pay back the investment that from China. And China would literally swap territory for that. For example, in Sri Lanka, as I mentioned, they had a 99-year lease on a port facility that we can very much see as a dual-use facility that could certainly have accommodate military presence at some point. You look a little further east to the South China Sea, you're militarizing these islands, and maybe we can get into more detail with that. So China, and think of all the other basket of things that China's doing that we think is of concern, IP theft, all manner of areas where China it seems to be competing with us and other countries in ways that we find very concerning. So China didn't go the direction we want. So at the end of the day, we realize we can't treat China and Russia for who we want them to be. We have to treat them for who they are.
Right.
So this national security strategy and the national defense strategy that flowed from it reflects that. And I think that a key component of that is we are in long-term competition with Russia and China, and we need to develop and execute a whole government response and compete effectively. It means we need to cooperate where we can, but we need to compete where we must.
Right. Now explain how NDS applies to India, the Pacific region, your corner of the world.
Sure. No thanks. And the NDS, it's there's a lot of parsimony. We got three major lines of effort, and I'll highlight them really quickly. First line of effort is we want to maintain a lethal force. And again, that's not because we want to go to war with the countries. It's in fact the opposite. We want a lethal force so that no country miscalculates that it can ever go choose conflict as an option with the United States. Mm-hmm. They're going to be forced to pursue their interests through diplomacy and other means. Mm-hmm. Second line of effort is, which is the line of effort I focused on, is strengthening alliances and building partnerships. Mm-hmm. And I'll hit that in a second. And the third line of effort is reforming the Defense Department. So for me, and this is Secretary Mattis was very clear in his guidance, he absolutely emphasized the importance of this second line of effort of strengthening alliances and building new partnerships. This is where I focus. So for me in my region, which really extended from India to Hawaii and all the many interesting countries in between, we strengthened our alliances. And we have five important alliances in that region. Of course, Japan and South Korea, and then in my region we had Thailand, Philippines, and Australia. So I want to strengthen those alliances, and I can certainly go into detail on any of those. And building partnerships, I would highlight one really important partnership, and that's with India. I mean, this is what we call a major defense partnership with India, the only one mm-hmm. of its kind. And with Secretary Mattis's emphasis, we made a real priority of building that partnership with India. I mean, this is a country with shared values and interests with the United States. They just had the world's largest democratic election in the history mm-hmm. of the planet. So world's largest democracy, a lot of shared interests there. And then just great power competition is back. Old school international relations theory is back. We both have our concerns about their neighbor, China, and that certainly emphasized that this is it's in our mutual interest to cooperate. Mm-hmm. So we made some great advances in the 2 years under Secretary Mattis's leadership, and then with his successors. We put meat on the bones of this major defense partnership, and I could give you some more detail if you want or move
far,
on to
far away.
Yeah, sure. So Within it, we had our first of all, we renamed the region, the Indo-Pacific region, which, again, it wasn't necessary for India, but it was a recognition of the importance.
Highlights their prominence.
Of the Indian Ocean region, mm-hmm. and certainly the biggest country there, being India, and how that you can't disconnect the Indian Ocean region and the Pacific region, that it really is, must be viewed with you know, together. And it really was a nod towards India's emerging leadership role as a regional power in the Indian Ocean region. We've had some major high-level meetings. Secretary Mattis and Secretary Pompeo met in September of last year with their counterparts in Delhi, which the first type of meeting that India's ever had at that level, and the first time the United States has ever had a meeting like that with mm-hmm. India. At that, we signed what we called one of our major enabling agreements, the Communications Compatibility and Security Agreement. This is something that I was very much involved with as the U.S. lead negotiator for the months leading up to that. And this allows us to share technology, to communicate in secure means. Basically, it opens up all manner of opportunities for interoperability with India and not just the U.S., but our allies and partners that also have signed this agreement. So we're much more interoperable with India and increasing our bilateral exercises and the multilateral exercises that India has across the region.
Let's talk brass tacks, Joe. What does India want from us, and what do we want from India?
So, fair question. I think we both want a good partner. A reliable partner in the region, and it does go both ways. So India looking to us, that again, I think a reliable partner is important to them. They would like to build their, in my lane, building military capabilities. They would like to have greater technology transfer. They would like access to our more advanced weapons, mm-hmm. and we're absolutely moving down that road. I mentioned that enabling agreement at Kamkasa was a significant step towards that.
So what are they after, like planes and submarines or...?
Well, and this is interesting. So India, as many know, has a legacy of procuring weapons from Russia.
Right.
And this has become a bit challenging for the relationship.
Yeah, it used to be they would get hand-me-downs from the Royal Navy, from the British Royal Navy, but now they switched. After that, they switched to the Russians.
We had a chilled relationship in decades past. And, mm-hmm. and because of that, although they've now become... they're much more looking to the West and the United States in particular for procurement. Mm-hmm. They have these legacy systems that they need spare parts. They can't just cut themselves off from Russia.
Right.
So there's a bit of a tension there, as the United States would like to see them, you know, buy more American or certainly buy things other than Russian for a number of reasons. But India has this need to maintain its legacy systems. They can't just cut it off. So that's a bit of a tension, and we're trying to work through that. But I mentioned what India would like from the U.S., but the U.S. from India, they would also like a reliable partner. And I think they would like to see promising indications that if we recognize that our interests are in building a cooperative relationship with the U.S. and other allies and partners in the region, let's, mm-hmm. Let's walk the walk. And as you make decisions about future high-end weapon systems, for example, mm-hmm. as you mentioned, submarines and whatnot, you know, fighters. Let's consider that you're not just buying equipment; you're investing in a relationship. And for example, they have a fighter competition out now where they're going to purchase for their army and navy fighters, either a single engine and or dual engine. And we'd like to see the F-18 as a contender, the F-16, the F-21, F-21 as a contender. And,
mm-hmm.
I think it would be a great indicator of their commitment to the relationship if, if a U.S. solution, made it to the front in one of those competitions.
And as India looks at the Indian Ocean, Joe, is it a case of Mare Nostrum? Do they consider that their backyard, their water?
Yeah, they do. I think India thinks its natural place in the region is as a regional power and as an increasingly mm-hmm. influential global power. And we absolutely, it's in our interest and it's India's interest. And I would argue it's in the interest of every country that wants a free and open Indo-Pacific region,
right.
and a region that where all countries, are protected by a rules-based order.
Mm-hmm.
I think a strong India is good for India. It's good for the United States. It's good for the region. It's good for the planet.
Now, a lot of other nations we have not talked about yet. We haven't talked about Thailand, the Philippines, Australia, for example. Let's break these down this way, Joe. I heard a very clever line the other day in discussing the relationship we have with the Kurds and the Turks. And the clever line was that the Kurds are our friends, but they're not our allies. The Turks, on the other hand, are our allies, but they're not our friends. So let's look at this region and let's break this down in terms of friends, allies. Do we have frenemies? Do we have enemies?
Yeah, that's a great, great question. And, this is I've been out of the government a little over a month now, and I'm a little free, more free to speak freely, although this is a podcast. But it's a great point. So let me maybe look at some of the allies in the region that I focused on.
Be careful now. You're a retired colonel. I don't want to mess with your pension here.
Well, for example, let's look at Thailand, treaty ally, our oldest treaty ally in the region. And for those of us that remember the Vietnam War years, a great partner during some tough times or during conflicts in Southeast Asia. Mm-hmm. But I'll admit, although they are a strong treaty ally, you know, China is doing, as they do across the region, making a full-court press in Thailand, trying to drive a wedge between the U.S. and Thailand. And let's hope that they're not successful. But we have noticed, some, I wouldn't say chilling in the relationship, but some developments in the U.S.-Thai relationship, which we'd like to see steer back towards,
How does China try to insert a wedge, Joe? Is it loaning money? Is it offering technology? Is it building things?
All the above and then some. Mm-hmm. You know, certainly it's investments.
Right.
And they're there. They're close. They've got lots of money, and they're mm-hmm. willing to invest quite a bit. So it's understandable how these countries are receptive to investment. But as we've seen across the region, there's strings tied to these investments. Mm-hmm. We don't want to rule out Chinese investment out of hand, but we want to make sure these investments are in the interest of the target country. If I could detour a little bit, I remember in Nepal a few months back, I was visiting, and Chinese are very much investing there. And I made what I thought was a benign statement in a press interview that, you know, we welcome Chinese investment in Nepal, but we hope that the investment is in the interest of Nepal as well as China. And the next day, the Chinese ambassador in Kathmandu, all over the headlines, just pushing back. I mean, I kind of hit a soft spot there, I think. Because mm-hmm. I think the truth is, I think they recognize that Chinese investment is often certainly much in the interest of China's, but not always so much in the interest of the target countries. And we've seen these examples in Thailand as well. Thailand and China were co-chairs of an expert working group for the ASEAN Defense Ministers meeting, 80-man plus, where they had their expert working group for terrorism. This is just one example about some of our concerns about China putting a wedge. Mm-hmm. And China insisted on having one of its major exercises in China, knowing full well that would limit U.S. participation in the exercise. So there's an example.
Right.
But again, we've got a long and solid relationship with Thailand, and we hope that will continue. So I just use that as an example. Going across the region to other allies, if you want to stay on this theme, mm-hmm. Bill, Australia, I mean, what a strong ally. They have fought with us in every conflict since World War I. Last year, we celebrate what we call the first 100 years of mateship. And it's not 100 years of mateship. For emphasis and effect, they say they want to celebrate the first 100 years of mateship dating back to a really important battle in World War I. Actually, it was fought on the 4th of July.
Right.
And they've been a tremendous partner in the region. And I know that Secretary Mattis was very, I don't want to speak for him, but he was a lot of emphasis on working with allies like Australia, that you know, this is the region, this is their neighborhood, let's get behind Australia and support them and work and buy with and through, to use a special forces term. So Australia has been a fantastic ally.
Joe, the India question, what does Australia want from us? What do we want from Australia?
Yeah, so again, I think Australia wants, a reliable partner, mm-hmm. also access to our best technology, mm-hmm. And we're able to share a lot. You know, as a Five Eyes partner, we share just about everything with Australia, F-35, amongst other things.
Have they been affected by our trade dispute with China?
Every country is to some degree, and this is challenging. And I tell you, when I'm in the region, I can talk all day about the importance and the value of a security partnership. Mm-hmm. But admittedly, when I'm the only American official in the room and have to answer some of the tough economic questions, that's a little more challenging. Mm-hmm. I think many countries recognize that the risks and perils, if you will, if I can be that bold, of some Chinese investment, but they look to alternatives. And in some cases, they don't see a lot of alternatives to the overwhelming Chinese investment that's available to them. But Australia, they've got domestic pressures. They may recognize, for example, that Huawei 5G maybe pose risks, but there's an economic risk to being viewed as too close to the United States, and mm-hmm. countries have to balance that with their economic interest. Right. And encouraging Australia has, we think, has made very pragmatic and choices that we support when they make that calculus, but. You know, it's a long game, and China's going to be pressuring and penalizing countries economically for perceived moves that bring them closer to the United States in the security dimension.
Right. Now let's talk about the Philippines, and let's talk about a word that hasn't entered this conversation so far, and that word is terrorism.
Sure. Yeah, Philippines. So I've spent a lot of time in the Philippines personally, several years there as a military attaché, and a lot of good friends and almost like family for me there. But the Philippines, and let me describe our relationship with the Philippines in a way that may sound a little crass, but give me a chance to put it in context. When I describe the relationship with the Philippines, I use this term. It's Yankee go home, take me with you. Mm-hmm. And what I mean by that is, you know, they're a proud, sovereign, independent country. You know, they were a former U.S. colony, and we need to be very cognizant that they're not a colony. They are an independent country.
This has to be a complicated relationship, Joe, because it begins with 1898. It goes into colonial years. It goes into Japanese occupation, Japanese liberation. It then goes into the Marcos years, but now it goes into the post-Marcos years.
It is complicated. And we got off to a tough, a rocky start in the Philippines. And we fought a war there.
Right.
And the Philippines, they hoped we would come there and liberate them from Spanish colonialism. But then we decided to stick around, and the Philippines became one of our first colonies. And admittedly, it was a very bloody war at the turn of the century. And so a tough way to start. Things got much better after that. If you have to be a colony, U.S. colonization period, there were some upsides. You know,
right.
we really invested in education in the country,
right.
Teaching English, trying to get them on their feet. But again, they were a colony. No
right.
country wants to be a colony. World War II, tremendous partners fought side by side with us.
Mm-hmm.
You know, from a Corregidor and on through. You know, the guerrillas. So fought and died with Americans. They're very very close. Got their independence after World War II. We had a mutual defense treaty in 1951. They've been a close treaty ally ever since. But again, we have to be cognizant of that tension. That they're an independent country of a culture. We are so close to them I can't overstate the cultural ties and the affinity that we share.
So today's Philippines and your line, Yankee, go home and take me with you.
Yeah, if I don't misinterpret that. But it's, and by that it says, again, respect their sovereignty, mm-hmm. but appreciate that we are very close culturally. And we share a lot of common bonds.
Mm-hmm. So let's talk about terrorism in the Philippines.
Yeah. Sure. So back in 2017, a place in the southern Philippines, central Mindanao Island called Marawi,
mm-hmm.
basically came under siege by ISIS militants.
Right.
And it was just a real wake-up call that ISIS, it is a global threat, and it can manifest itself anywhere in the world. And here it is in Southeast Asia. They really took over a town. It became a very, very bloody fight. It was, and I visited Marawi. It looked like something out of Dresden in the war. I've never seen devastation like that anywhere. And you know, I've been to some tough places in Iraq, for example. But the armed forces of the Philippines were able to root them out. This is tough fighting. This is literally street to street, building to building, room to room type of fighting. Lots of casualties.
Who is they? Who are they rooting out?
So this is a great question. So ostensibly they claimed allegiance with ISIS,
mm-hmm.
ISIS in the Philippines, but these are militants in the Philippines. I like to say that there have been groups in the Philippines that have been resisting Christian domination of their country since Magellan showed up in the 1521, I believe it was.
Right.
So there's a part of the Philippines, certainly in the southern areas, that never wanted to be part of a Christian dominated state, and so you've seen various manifestations of these separatist groups over time.
Mm-hmm.
But ISIS, a few years ago, you might have called them Abu Sayyaf group. A few years before that, you might have called them Moral Islamic Liberation Front, Moral National Liberation Front. So this is these groups have morphed. But in this case, in Marawi, they claimed allegiance to ISIS, important. It wasn't just a Philippines problem. In Southeast Asia, we saw militants like from Indonesia travel to Syria to participate in this jihad, as they called it. Now they've got a more local option.
Mm-hmm.
You know, they can go to the Philippines and also participate in this jihad that inspires these largely young men around the world to sign up for. So it was a wake up call. The Philippines recognized it. The United States. This was a great example, I think, about. Of an effective partnership, supporting a treaty ally. We were invited to provide some technical support to help the armed force of the Philippines, some intelligence collection and dissemination, and help them with their targeting. And so it was a great example of a treaty ally being invited and delivering in a way that no other country, certainly China, could do.
Right. You mentioned the Philippine Armed Forces are dealing with this. Are they getting any help from the Americans, the aforementioned SOF?
Yes. So yes. We've since, and I was in the Philippines on 9/11. Actually, I almost slept through it. It was late at night. Oh. but we had problems in the southern Philippines with these extremist groups. A lot of them were kind of gray area between criminal and extremist groups,
right.
Taking U.S. and Western and other countries hostage. But we've had since 9/11 we've had a special operations force presence in the Philippines, mm-hmm. a very small presence based out of the southern Philippines, like Zamboanga and other areas, where we've provided assistance as invited by the Armed Forces of the Philippines to help them interdict this insidious terrorist threat. So mm-hmm. we have forces there, a very, very, very small footprint on the ground there. Operation Pacific Eagle is what we call it now. Mm-hmm. And again, it's a very small presence that helps the Philippines with intelligence and targeting information.
Interesting. We haven't talked about Indonesia yet.
Indonesia.
World's largest Muslim population.
World's largest, absolutely. And we're developing a great relationship with Indonesia. And they've got, to their credit, this is a large, diverse country. Mm-hmm. But they've, they've held things together pretty well. Right. The recent election of Jokowi, so he's been reelected. But we are building our relationship with in Indonesia. Mm-hmm. Interestingly, their chief of their army and potentially chief of their military candidate is a good friend of mine that I worked with back in the 90s. Mm-hmm. When I was in Special Forces, but I'm very encouraged by our developing relationship with Indonesia. There's certainly, you mentioned the war, that the terrorism challenge in the region. Mm-hmm. They've championed some regional initiatives for counterterrorism, something called an Our Eyes Initiative, and I'm not sure how much of this is open source, but it's an effort to bring regional partners together to help combat the terrorism challenges in the region. But we see, Indonesia has traditionally been a leader of the non-aligned movement, a leader in the region. When we call it the Indo-Pacific region, they literally straddle the Indian and Pacific Oceans.
Right. Let's spend another minute on Indonesia, Joe, and explain to me two things. Number one, the political situation today, because this is a country that 50, 60 years ago was flirting with dictatorships, communism, and so forth. It was a cauldron. People have probably seen The Year of Living Dangerously, great movie, which gets into the uprising in the 1960s in Indonesia. And then secondly, the brass tacks questions with the other countries. What do they want? What do we want?
So in Indonesia, you mentioned terrorism. We have a great partnership with them in mm-hmm. combating terrorism. Certainly a huge country. We have economic interest there. We're expanding our mill-to-mill exercises in the region. They've been interested in purchasing some U.S. High-end defense equipment, which again, it's not just an investment in quality. I would argue the best quality equipment, but it's an investment in a longer-term relationship.
Right.
We want a partner. Again, Indonesia is independent. When Secretary Mattis would go to Indonesia, he would say, you may be not aligned, but we're aligned with you. And in that, he meant that, hey, we absolutely respect your independence and sovereignty, but we have shared interests, shared values, large democracies that want to see a free and open region and a rules-based order survive. So great, great partner in the region. We shouldn't expect them to be an ally, but we should expect them to be if we invest, the partnership will grow.
So let me ask you a big picture question, Joe, because this is a big swath of the world. I was looking up Australasia, for example, is 8.5 million square miles. It's a big chunk of real estate. One thing the United States has learned the hard way since the end of the Cold War, not all nations, not all cultures take a shine to democracy and free markets. We've learned this lesson very much the hard way in Russia. We've learned this lesson very much the hard way in Afghanistan and Iraq, where it's cost us a lot of treasure. As you look at this region, is this region fundamentally warm and open to democracy?
Yeah.
Is it warm and open to capitalism? Or are we trying to introduce something new that these cultures historically just do not understand?
Sure. No, it's a great question. But I would say, certainly, much of the region is warm and open. So you look mm-hmm. at India,
right?
You look at some of the big democracies there: in India, Japan, South Korea, Australia. Mm-hmm. Those are healthy, vibrant democracies.
Well, I think there's always been an entrepreneurial spirit in this part of the world, Joe. But the question is, in terms of just the freedoms that we sometimes take for granted in this country, do those nations accept freedoms? Freedoms of speech, freedom of expression, yeah. just the things of the United States which make us special.
It's a mix, and I think where I'd like to take this question is. democracy a prerequisite for a close partnership with the United States? Mm-hmm. Is it something that we encourage states to a path to pursue and help nurture those that have chosen the path? But it is not a prerequisite. A great example is Vietnam, one of our closest partners, developing partners in the region. Vietnam is a communist country. We always had a challenged past with Vietnam. Mm-hmm. From the security perspective, Vietnam is, again, one of our closest partners in holding China accountable for some of its illegal activities in the South China Sea, for example. They are willing to acknowledge it. What China's doing is against international law and cannot stand. So our partnership, I visited Vietnam several times, twice with Secretary Mattis, actually. Could not overstate the importance of that relationship and the fact that we accept that they have a different form of government than we do, but it doesn't preclude us from cooperating and building a close partnership. So the way I'll answer that question, Bill, is again, we personally believe that democracy is a preferred form of government for countries mm-hmm. and their citizens, but we also recognize the importance of building partnerships based on a shared vision for the future of the region, and not necessarily a shared understanding of what type of government system is going to work for your country.
Right. Now, you haven't been back here for very long, Joe, and it's great to have you back, but you're going to notice something as you start sitting in on speeches and lectures and talks, especially when the conversation turns to China. And depending, Joe, on which fellow is doing the talking, you either get a very bleak view of China, that we're on a collision course with them economically, militarily, or you'll have fellows, I'm not going to name names, but you'll have other fellows who say, this is much ado about nothing. They're just not in the same league with us economically and certainly not militarily. The threat is overblown. Let's talk about your corner of the world. And are you bearish or bullish about the future of this region?
Yeah.
I think you're a bull.
I am. Yeah. I am. I think that, going back to my earlier discussion about 1990 and how we looked at China then, where we thought that, China's going to reform, it's going to change, it's going to become a responsible member of the international community. I still agree with that. I think we got our timing wrong. I think that what back then we thought maybe happen in a decade, it may be many decades mm-hmm. Before that happens. But at the end of the day, for the same reasons we were hopeful in 1990, they haven't gone away. Look what's happening in Hong Kong now. Clearly, internally, there's a lot of concern amongst the Chinese about, is the Chinese Communist Party going to get us where we want to go and continue to get the support we need? They're firmly in control. It's not going to happen anytime soon. But I would say I'm bullish because I think that the triumph of ideals... Our vision for the future, I think, is a vision that's shared across the region. And I would argue potentially even someday in China. Mm-hmm. So I think it's challenging for us now, and this is really the gist of our national defense strategy, to tie that back in, is cooperate where we can, compete where we must. In the case of China, keep the door open to cooperation. Encourage that cooperation where we can. Keep the door closed to any actions on their part that undermine state sovereignty mm-hmm. or violate the rules-based order. But eventually, China, it may come around. We can't be naively optimistic, but let's not, to use Secretary Mattis's term, is let's hold the line. Let's hold the line for a better China, and let's create incentives and disincentives for them to move down that path. I think the timings could be, you and I don't know where you were in 1990, but I was surprised when the wall came down. I was newly commissioned. We may be surprised, things may happen in the aftermath of Hong Kong, for example. I don't think so. I think it's going to be decades, but I do think at the end of the day, the vision that we have for the future of that region, free and open and a rules-based order, is ultimately might be shared by the Chinese people too, and there may be demands internally for reforms in China. But until then, let's not let them compete effectively with us and undermine the sovereignty of any countries in the region.
Okay, final question, sir, and let's focus on the Indo in the Indo-Pacific, yeah. And that's India, where you were just last week, right?
Yeah, just a few days ago.
If Secretary Schultz were sitting in here, he would want to bring up climate change.
Yeah.
As we look at our evolving relationship with India, and certainly we love the fact that they've embraced democracy, and they do democracy in some regards better than we do, certainly in terms of integrity of elections. As we look at a vibrant economy, as we look at them gearing up in many regards, how does climate change figure into this?
Well, again, the closer partnership we have, India's voice resonates mm-hmm. across the region in ways that...
Right.
Admittedly, the U.S. voice doesn't always resonate. If India is a voice that encourages cooperation and climate change, they can encourage states to adjust behavior in ways that the United States would have a lot more challenges just based on our relationships. So Again, all the more important reason for building a close partnership with India, and encouraging it to be a force for encouraging the type of behavior activities across the region that are more consistent with responding to that threat.
Okay, final question, Joe Felter, and I do appreciate your time. If there is a change of power in the United States a year from now, 13 months from now, new regime comes into Washington, somebody comes in and they want to do their own national security strategy, they come to you and they want to talk about the Indo-Pacific region, what are your do's and what are your don'ts?
Yeah.
With a real emphasis on the don'ts.
So, I'm a political scientist by training. I would say national interests are enduring. Mm-hmm. So if we have a second Trump administration or new administration, our national interests will be enduring. Certainly, we may articulate and package those interests differently if there is a new administration. We have a new national security strategy. But I guess my don'ts, and I'll go back to the line of effort in our national defense strategy that I really focused on, and I think that Secretary Mattis, during his tenure, was his priority, is strengthen alliances and building partnerships. Mm-hmm. And again, I quoted Secretary Mattis a lot because he was, the defense secretary for most of my tenure. But he would say that, countries with allies thrive and countries without them fail. Mm-hmm. And so let's not squander the relationships that we built across this region, invested decades, if not centuries, in building. So, the threats out there are challenging. It's going it alone is going to be tough. U.S. with allies and partners is very formidable. So I would say the don't would be don't squander the relationships, don't undermine, erode alliances, find ways to... We have a shared vision with these allies and partners, and let's pursue it together. And I would argue if we work together in all these areas, like the South China Sea and in many areas, U.S. allies and partners together, we're going to advance those interests.
Okay. Colonel Dr. Joseph Felter, I appreciate your time in doing the podcast. It's great to have you back at Stanford. Most importantly, thank you for your service.
Thanks, Bill. Thanks for the chance to be here.
You've been listening to Area 45, a Hoover Institution podcast on the policy avenues available to the 45th President of the United States. In this podcast, the challenges facing America in the South and Southeast Asia and the Oceania region. If you've been enjoying Area 45, please don't forget to rate, review, and subscribe to us on iTunes and tell your friends about us. By the way, this is not the only Hoover podcast. There is Econ Talk, the classicist with the great Victor Davis Hanson, the libertarian with the redoubtable Richard Epstein. We also convert fellow speeches into podcasts you can easily download. I'm warning you right now, Joe Felter, you may be on a podcast of your own one day soon. And where do you find all of this? www.hoover.org, the Hoover website. And while you're there, while I'm assigning you homework, sign up for the Hoover Daily Report, which delivers the best work of Hoover's fellows. That certainly includes Joe Felter, straight to your inbox weekdays. The Hoover Institution has Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter feeds. Our Twitter handle is @HooverInst. That's @HooverInst. Joe Felter, I believe, is not on Twitter. I found some very random dudes named Joe Felter, but I don't think you're one of them.
I think I should be. If not, I'll get there. I need to up my game, Bill.
And we'll talk about this off the podcast. But it is good to have you back. And again, thank you for your service to this nation.
Thanks, Bill.
For the Hoover Institution, this is Bill Whalen. We'll be back soon with another installment of Area 45. Until then, take care. Thanks for listening.
For more podcasts from the Hoover Institution, please visit hoover.org or Hoover's channels on iTunes, iTunes U, Stitcher, and SoundCloud. I'm Chris Dauer for the Hoover Institution. Thanks for listening.